Hello and welcome to Broadband. Here at Broadband, we live by the philosophy that one needs other human beings to teach them how to be human. Our guide for today on this journey of communal actualization is Yasmina Elmulla, an NYU-trained political scientist and freelance journalist whose words frequently appear on Gulf News, Politics Today, Kuwait Times, Middle East Eye, and Recife 22. Yasmina mainly covers political, social, and human rights issues. As of late, she's been providing her readers with on-the-ground coverage of the Kuwaiti women's rights movement. I want to set the stage for this interview by shining the spotlight on three main points of focus for our dialogue. The first being Yasmina and her unique human journey. Next, I want to explore the complex, dynamic, and at times disturbing world that is women's lives in the Middle East and their movement, which is drawing attention on a global scale. And finally, with Yasmina's insights, I want to provide you, the listener, with the best practices for effective communication on matters that may be political or social in nature that frequently stir up reptilian emotions. Without further ado, hello, Yasmina. How are you?
Hi, Aziz. Hello. I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciate having you on. So let's start this dialogue by taking a trip down memory lane. Do you remember the moment where, as a teenager, getting ready for college, you decided to pursue journalism?
So I actually did not decide to pursue journalism right out of high school. I was actually going to study under a major at NYU called Media Culture and Communication. And that didn't work out. So I was told, okay, try to join the journalism program and then, you know, you can get into it from there. And then I took one political science class and I was like, oh, this is super interesting. And then I realized that they complement each other. So yeah, I ended up sticking with journalism and adding political science into the mix.
Which is perfect for what you do here in the Middle East, because you mainly cover the politics and human rights and social issues. And so you've really married the two best majors. And you did it in NYU, which is a prestigious university, and in one of the best, and this, I think this is highly contested, but it's one of the best cities in the entire world, New York, New York. In New York, right, there is a very popular Instagram account called Humans of New York, and it's one of the, in my opinion, one of the best journalistic pieces that we have online, right? And it's something that, you know, a normal citizen just started on a whim and just kind of became huge and can document the lives of New Yorkers at a very deep level. So what is the role of journalists today in the age of social media and technology, where bystanders can document and broadcast historic events with a click of a button, sometimes better than the traditional journalist?
No, for sure. You said that perfectly. And there's actually a term for that, and it's called citizen journalism. And it's like anyone that has a cell phone, a tablet, a laptop, whatever, some form of device can pull out and capture any moment in front of them and publish it on social media and so forth, and definitely serve as a worthy testimony of what's happening on the ground. And you'll see, for example, that big publication like Reuters, for example, has a special Twitter account called Reuters Eyewitness or Witness Watch that basically just goes through social media and looks for videos or photos that they can use then to incorporate in their either video productions or print pieces that are taken by, you know, the average citizen. And so to answer your question, anyone can, you know, be a reporter today. And so I would definitely say I'm a huge advocate of social media, but at the same time, I'm also a skeptic, because there is a lot on social media and there's a lot that you have to filter through to get to the actual hard fact truths. And there is, you know, I hate using this word, but a lot of fake news out there that, you know, not everyone would necessarily see it as fake news, because we started taking news on social media as, you know, this is it. This is the accurate thing.
Okay, well, the more eyes on an article, right, the more successful the journalist. And I've noticed a great deal of provocative titles and articles as a method of remaining relevant. So how fine is the line between being provocative to invite an audience and start a discourse and being provocative to create chaos and sow discord?
So that's a really thin line, and it's very difficult. And, you know, because the word provocative is very subjective, it's something that is provocative can be different to me and can be different to you, Aziz. And so I am just a firm believer that you can't capture something you want to say in 10 to 15 words. And that's why they always say headlines are misleading. And I agree, because there's only so much you can say. And there's this term that's used in the news world, and it's called SEO, and it's search engine optimization. And so that's what, you know, you try to do, is you try to insert as many search optimized words in your headline so that your article can appear first. So for example, since we're, you know, in the COVID times, having words like COVID, vaccine, travel, I don't know, those words are currently SEOs. And so having those in your headline will likely bump up the chances of people that read your article. And so it's a thin line, and you just have to decide by yourself, are you ready to go down the track of playing it safe and not gaining as many views as possible, or taking the route and maybe being a bit more provocative and stirring up some controversy?
And how would you interact with a journalistic or pseudo-journalistic environment that craves clickbait and asks provocative questions to muddy the message with emotion?
There's this ongoing conversation about with journalists, you know, across the world. And it's like, you know, when do you draw the line? When do you, you know, say, okay, this is where I am going to stop, because now I am infringing on someone's, you know, maybe privacy, or, you know, taking it a bit too far. And I actually remember this, a huge conversation was sparked. I don't know if you or your listeners remember the little Syrian boy that was washed off the shores of the water, and the photo was taken of him face down, you know, like Hamad dead by the shores as he was trying to escape war-torn Syria and make it to Europe. And I remember that photo was seen by people, you know, all over the world, if not almost everyone that has access to some form of social media, sparked conversation and said, while yes, this definitely shed light on the suffrage of Syrian refugees, was it worth taking that photo?
That's a very good point. That's a very good point, because my knee-jerk reaction would be like, we should have, I mean, the age of information, we should have access to as much information as possible. But what that does is you could be receiving that information at the cost of some other person's life and emotions and suffering, right? So it's a big paradigm shifter there for me. So thank you for bringing that up. And speaking of provocative, journalism falls under the umbrella of the mass media machine. So I want to get your opinion on something. So we've all heard of and repeated the adage, sex sells. And studies show that not only does sex not sell, but it can also turn consumers off of products. A study published in the Journal of Research Sex Roles found that women showed lower product attractiveness and purchase intentions toward products presented with sexualized female models. Men's purchase intentions were unaffected by those ads. So why, in your opinion, does the big media machine constantly sexualize and objectify the female body?
Okay, so for starters, I would say that the media sexualizes, you know, the female body because it comes with a long and deep-rooted system of misogyny. So if you look at who owns the biggest and most powerful news corporations in the world, all top 15 companies are run by men. So what does that say? You know, it says that the CEOs running these big conglomerates are looking at it from a male lens, and therefore there is no enough female representation, and therefore there isn't space for a woman to be like, wait, maybe this is problematic. And, you know, not only puts women off, but does not, you know, bring in more men, readers, viewers, whatever, you know, your content may be. So I think it's because, like many industries throughout the world are run by men, and the lack of diversity has allowed for this phenomenon to continue.
Right. I think the discussions that you're having aren't as important as the discussions that you're not having. And not having women representation in those boardrooms means that there are a lot of discussions not being had, a lot of important ones. So nonetheless, women are still being sexualized. The Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media released 10 years worth of data showing that women are sexualized 6 times more than men. So what are some of the negative effects that this representation have on girls and women's psychological and physical well-being?
So it definitely does have a negative impact because we consume media more than ever, whether it be social media, whether it be movies, YouTube, TV shows. These are all falling under the umbrella of media. And when you see basically like sexualized versions of women, you will start believing that this is the norm. And you will start thinking like, okay, I guess this is how women should look like, when in actual fact, it's not. And for example, when you look at women on TV, you know, female correspondents on air, you will see that oftentimes they're wearing, you know, tight dresses or like skirts or tighter pants and so forth. And the question is, why is that?
Hey guys, this is the part of the podcast where people usually tell you to buy this product or subscribe to this service, but we don't have any sponsors yet. So we'll sell ourselves instead. We have four simple asks. One, please subscribe if you haven't already. Two, share the podcast. Share it with your friends, share it with your family, and share it with a stranger. Start a conversation. Three, check out the show notes. You can find all the references that we've already made and are about to make on there. And four, engage with us on Instagram and email. Enjoy the rest of the show. So it's been empirically proven that frequent exposure to this kind of content is directly associated with a range of consequences. A couple of those consequences is a higher tolerance towards sexual harassment and the rape myth acceptance. So what's Kuwait's general attitude toward the sexual harassment of women?
Okay, so before we start, I definitely want to point out that while your question states sexual harassment, I want to take a step back and address that there are different forms of harassment. And so there is obviously sexual harassment, there's verbal harassment, you know, catcalling falls under that. There is financial harassment, so withholding funds and other form of goods. There is psychological harassment. There are various forms of harassment, to name a few. And because they have all kind of morphed into this one understanding of harassment, goes back to your question of, you know, Kuwait's general attitude towards sexual harassment kind of normalized it because we do not differentiate between these different kinds of harassment. So if you were to go on today on the streets and conduct a poll and say, like, have you ever, you know, physically assaulted a woman? The percentage will probably be much less than if you asked men, have you ever catcalled a woman? Because in their eyes, harassment is physical. Harassment is assault. It's not, you know, rolling down the windows and, you know, like saying something like, hey, you look good today, or I don't know, take my number or whatever. Another form of it being like manipulation. Those are not viewed as harassment. So to basically summarize what you were asking was that the general attitude towards harassment in Kuwait is, I want to say, not widely accepted, but rather misunderstood, therefore is normalized.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm not fully convinced that the boys will be boys attitude is at all acceptable, because, I mean, the harassment of women is unaccepted, but it's normalized and boys will be boys, mm-hmm. right? And I think that is as toxic as fully being on board with sexual or financial or verbal harassment, right? So
exactly.
Right. So Maslow's hierarchy of needs states that for an individual to be able to self-actualize, one needs necessities like food, water, and shelter. And if I were to compare the women's rights protest in the Eastern versus the Western hemisphere, the women in the East seem to still be fighting for basic rights like safety and freedom of mobility and freedom of self-expression. So what legislations are necessary for our Eastern movement to evolve to the next level?
Okay. So again, this has two folds. So first is, before we go into actually enacting new legislation, we need to get rid of old legislation. So for example, you have Article 153, which is discussing honor killings and basically treats it as a misdemeanor. Again, you almost never see any case be filed under Article 153, but having such law normalizes this violence because it values the woman's life less by making the punishment a misdemeanor. Then again, you have Article 152, which allows an abductor to escape punishment if he married the person he abducted or raped with permission of her guardian. Again, I go back to how many cases have we heard about the abductor, you know, marrying his rapist to escape punishment? Very little, but going back to it, normalizes violence against women. Under Article 29, disciplinary beatings are also sanctioned by law, according to the Penal Code. And so I can go on and on. You also have legislation that states that women can't pass on citizenship to her children. That's a form of psychological violence, you know, and so having these forms of legislation, it enables men to believe that they have the upper hand when it comes to the law over women. That's the first fold. The second fold, when you asked what legislation should be put in place, to be honest, the Kuwaiti constitution is one of the most fair constitutions in the world. It has deemed that men are women are equal in the eyes of the law and has, you know, given various freedoms that are very hard to take away. And so I think the problem is not with the law itself, but it's the application of the law. And so one of the laws I want to point to was back in August 2020, the parliament passed the Family Protection Law. And basically, it protects victims of domestic violence. But the problem is it's not active. Another article states that the state is required to protect victims of abuse. So if someone were to go into a police station and complain, the state or this respective authority is responsible of protecting said victim. That, unfortunately, is not the case. And we've seen it multiple times, unfortunately, a lot of times leading to death.
Right. Okay, so, but Fatma Ajmi's case was one of the most shocking things that I've ever read in my entire life. And I read your article about it, actually, initially. And so, can you share her story with our listeners who may not be familiar with Fatma Ajmi?
Sure. So Fatma Al-Ajmi, Allah irhamha, was a 35-year-old pregnant mother. She was married to her husband for 2 years. Although her father and her brother were okay with the marriage, one of her brothers wasn't. And so over the past 2 years, he threatened her several times and so forth, until one day he went into her house, fired a gunshot in her house where her child, where her one-year-old child was. Her husband then rushed her to the hospital, you know, so she can seek treatment. Although there was security forces at the hospital itself, he sneaked in from the back door, made his way to the ICU where she was being treated, shot her 4 times, where she eventually died in the bed of the ICU, Allah irhamha. So her and the child that was inside her. So it's a very, very tragic story. And it was a very horrific thing to hear. And while there were security forces there, it just goes to show that, you know, her brother wasn't going to stop at anything to ensure that, you know, he kills her, unfortunately.
Does that fall under Article 153? Is that considered an honor killing? I know she was married for 2 years. She has already a child with her husband. So did it fall under 153?
So technically, the Article 153 means if a husband, a father, or a son catches a female in the act of sexual activity and kills her, hence the wording, kills her by surprise, falls under 153. This was a planned, you know, he had the gun with him, he went to her house and he killed her.
Yeah, right. Well, the latest uproar was Farah Hamza Akbar's case, right? Allah irhamha. So what happened there and what are the latest details on that case?
Okay, so Farah Akbar's case was different than Fatma because it was not a family member, and that's very important to highlight. And so she was, again, happily married, you know, had a child of her own, and was being stalked by this man who has previously had 2 cases filed against him by Farah and her family for 1 kidnapping and 1 for attempted murder. And both times they filed cases at the public prosecutor's office and have gone from one police station to the other, trying to just get the security forces' attention and get any form of protection. And, you know, clearly this man was a threat to her life, until one day, unfortunately, he really was. And they were in the car. He bumped into the car, grabbed her from her car with her daughters, took him into his car, stabbed her several times in front of her daughter, drove her to the hospital, dropped her dead body at the hospital, left the child, and drove off.
And this wasn't something that was at all a surprise. I mean, there were two separate cases and pretty heavy cases. I mean, kidnapping and attempted murder, and he was still roaming the streets and he was still stalking her, and he ended up in her car and he stabbed her dead. So there's obviously some kind of holes that need to be, fixed in the system.
And like you said, there is a huge glitch in the system. And I think one of the things that came out of the uproar that happened following her death, and unfortunately, it took a soul to die for, people to really grasp how much danger women's lives are here in Kuwait. And unfortunately, what's worse is they're not taken seriously. And as I was writing about the piece, I've interviewed a bunch of people, and so many women have also had similar stories to tell, where they have went in to file a complaint against a perpetrator, whether it be someone they know or someone they don't know. And unfortunately, their claim was not taken seriously and was dismissed. And I think that is one of the main demands that are being called on by women here in Kuwait, is to actually take complaints seriously, and to, ensure that women's lives are protected.
Yeah, I think there needs to be some kind of reformation of the penal code so that there are safeguards for women. So our local listeners may have been familiar with Fatma Najmi and Farah Hamza Akbar's names, but a name that was less uttered was Ginilyn Villavendi, a Filipina domestic worker that was sexually assaulted and murdered late 2019. In an interview with Al-Qabas, Dr. Hanin Al-Ghabra says that one of the major flaws of the feminist movement is that it's highly designated to the bourgeoisie or upper middle class, and she urged true feminists to fight for their marginalized and at times voiceless sisters. So is the bourgeoisie-focused movement unique to Kuwait, or is it a flaw of the feminist movement as a whole?
So I just want to say I 1000% with Dora Hanin's words, and I think this is a conversation that needs to be kept, a conversation needs to keep happening, because I think, and I'll speak to the world and then speak to Kuwait, and I think across the world, oftentimes we hear some voices louder than others, and they tend to be the voices that have less to lose if they do speak. And so I think that is imitated here in Kuwait. And while I don't want to disregard anyone's work towards creating equal rights and justice, there are definitely voices that are left out of the conversation or are, heard less because they have more to lose. So migrant workers, domestic workers, Bedouin women definitely have more to lose because of the unfair legal, because they are, living in unfair circumstances here in Kuwait and have much more to lose, therefore are afraid to speak out. And so I think, it's very important to be inclusive as possible when talking about women's rights, but also ensuring to give voice to the voiceless and not speaking on behalf of them, but giving them the voice to speak, but in a way that does not infringe on their safety.
Phenomenal, phenomenal. But that's easier said than done. And
100%, yeah.
yeah, and I think with people like Dr. Hanin Al-Ghabra, who's getting out there and saying, hey, it's not enough. What we're doing is just the beginning of a very huge movement, is honestly giving me a lot of hope.
Yeah.
So being that you're an eloquently spoken communication steward, what tips do you have for people to be more effective at getting their message across?
So I would say try to speak in a manner that reaches as many people as possible. While sometimes, when you have, academic journals and so forth, you would try to use a little bit more fancy vocabulary, if I may say. Keeping it simple and to the point will actually let you reach more people than you think. Also, sometimes we tend to speak in a vacuum. So not only communicating with like-minded people might feel more comfortable and easy, but having these awkward and harder conversations is what's actually going to, let you get your message across. And also try to talk out of the bubble and talk to people that don't necessarily have the same viewpoint as you. So that goes back to, trying not to speak into this, vacuum.
How can we filter, and I know you hate this word, fake news from objective and neutral news?
Okay, so I would say number one, get your information from more than one source, because all of us, myself included, have our own biases, and sometimes it's hard to filter it out. And so reading or listening or, watching different publications or platforms and stuff can, you know, give you insight into a different point of view or perspective. And so definitely getting your information from one source is very important. I also say always follow on the ground journalists because they do fantastic work and they are very well versed in the environment that they're in. And so not only do they have an understanding for the certain topic that they're talking about or writing about, but they also understand the culture and the background and therefore have a more nuanced understanding of what's happening. And then finally, regardless of where you're getting your news from, always question the validity of what you're reading and do your own research.
You already mentioned one book to us and I'm getting greedy, but what's another book that inspired your life's journey?
Oof, easy. So there's this book. If you haven't read this book yet, you have to read it. It's called Our Women on the Ground. It's a fantastic, fantastic book. And I, you know, one of my all-time favorites. And it's basically a book that shares the story of 19 Arab journalists working across the region. And they're basically short essays about their lives. And it's just so well put together. The stories are so raw. It's very diverse. And it's a great, great book.
Okay, beautiful. So what's an important message that you want our audience to take away from our discussion? You've said so many important messages, but what's an important message that you want our audience to take away from our discussions?
So although there is so much, you know, online and, you know, so much news to consume, I always say whenever you are reading or listening or watching the news, be mindful that there is more that isn't being said. So I urge you to go and do your own research and try to look up information on your own because there is more to than what's being reported.
Phenomenal. You're absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I learned so much from this conversation. I look forward to having you back. So thank you, Yasmina.
Honestly, I enjoyed your questions. And so, no, thank you. This was a really, really fun podcast to do.
Thanks for coming on the show and we'll be talking to you soon. This podcast would not be possible without your support. So please subscribe to our podcast, share it with your friends and family, check out the show notes for any references made, and engage with us on Instagram and email. Thank you.